Well, this morning, we're going to start in the last chapter of Joshua. I normally have some kind of an idea about how much of that chapter or all of that chapter or where I'm going to wind up at the end of the class period. This one, I don't know. We'll just see how this takes us through. Last time we were in chapter 23, and in that chapter, it had already declared that Joshua was old, and we're going to see here in chapter 24, it's going to cite his death when we get around to reading that far in the chapter, at 110 years of age. It's been about 15 years in Joshua 23 since the land was apportioned to each of the tribes, maybe a little less than that. But he called all the tribes together. He proclaimed himself as old, advanced in years. The effects of age were catching up with him. And he reminds them all that they saw Yahweh God do many things during the conquest. And he brings up what Yahweh had done to the nations. He actually fought for Israel. And there were some remaining ethnic groups, nations, within the borders, but the war part was over. And now they had the responsibility to finish dispossessing these people of the land that God wanted them out. And Joshua talks about how during his leadership, the nations were cut off from the Jordan River to the sea. And so the nations are cut off, so now there's work to do, and he directs them, be strong, finish the task under Yahweh's promise. It was a promise of God that he would be a part of the energy and effort, would be the real force behind moving these people out. So he tells them, do what's written in the law of Moses, stay on course. And he gives them a primary reason for his saying that, a primary reason God said many times, was so that you don't associate with these people. And these ones that remain here will be a trap to you. Don't mention the name of their gods. Don't swear by them. Don't serve them. Don't bow down to them. Don't intermarry with people that follow these gods. Move these people out of your midst. Hold fast. Follow hard after Yahweh. And he says, for Yahweh had driven out great nations right in front of your eyes. So implying you should know God will do this, and he will do this as a part of your taking the responsibility to get it done. He says, one of you can cause 1,000 to flee. God fights for you. The strength of God is there. They see it. They know it. They're afraid of you. So move. Do it. Get it done. He also says, love Yahweh with all your heart. It's not just an obedience moment. It's also a relationship moment with God himself. Love him with all your heart. He moved you from being slaves to being here in the land that was promised to your forefathers. It's now promised to you. You've got it. Make the most of it by continued obedience and relationship with God out of a loving response to him. He says, if you ever turn back from Yahweh and serve these nations and gods or intermarry with them or they with you, be certain Yahweh will not continue with you. These people are a trap to you. They will become a whip to your sides and thorns in your eyes. I like those words enough. I brought them back today. Then to you will come death and loss of the land. God will not stop short of driving you out of the very land he promised to you. And that's the way it will be. Joshua then says, well, now I die. You know in your hearts and souls that not one word of the good words that Yahweh spoke to you has failed. Every last one of them has been fulfilled. You can look back, even though there were times you had doubts, there were times you thought you were in trouble, all of those things, God did just exactly what he promised to you. And so they're all fulfilled. But you can also be sure, he says, that the dire promises of turning away from God are just as certain as the good promises. In other words, there is a risk here for you if you do not remain faithful to Yahweh, have a loving relationship with him, and follow him. So he says again, cling to Yahweh, as you have until this day. In other words, through the whole conquest, a couple of false starts up front by Achan keeping some things that were banned when they overran Jericho, and so on. There were a couple of hiccups, but he said, you have followed through on what God asked you to do. Keep doing it. And we talked about a similar concern then for us as believers, how it's easy to become complacent to those things around us. We looked at 1 John 2:15 and 16. Don't love the world or the things in the world, because everything that's in the world does not come from God, but comes from the world. It's against God. James 4:10 says, if you love the world, don't you know that means you're an enemy to God? And that takes us then today to Joshua chapter 24. And I'm going to begin with the first 13 verses of Joshua 24. So let me read those. Now it came about after many days, when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies on every side, and Joshua was old, advanced in years, that Joshua called for all Israel, for all their elders and their heads and their judges and their officers, and said to them, I'm old, advanced in years, and you've seen that the Lord your God has done to... I'm sorry. Now let's turn the page and read chapter 24. I'm thinking, that doesn't sound quite right. It was close. Now let me go to chapter 24 and try that again. Okay. Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, and he called for the elders of Israel and for their heads and for their judges and their officers, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua said to all the people, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, from ancient times your fathers lived beyond the river, namely Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led him through all the land of Canaan and multiplied his descendants and gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau, and to Esau I gave Mount Seir to possess it. But Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt. Then I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt by what I did in its midst, and afterward I brought you out. I brought out your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea, and Egypt pursued your fathers with chariots and horsemen to the Red Sea. But when they cried out to the Lord, he put darkness between you and the Egyptians, and brought the sea upon them and covered them, and your own eyes saw what I did in Egypt, and you lived in the wilderness for a long time. Then I brought you to the land of the Amorites, who lived beyond the Jordan, and they fought with you, and I gave them into your hand, and you took possession of their land when I destroyed them before you. Then Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, arose and fought against Israel, and he sent and summoned Balaam, the son of Beor, to curse you. But I was not willing to listen to Balaam, so he had to bless you, and I delivered you from his hand. You crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho, and the citizens of Jericho fought against you, and the Amorite, and the Perizzite, and the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Thus I gave them into your hand. Then I sent the hornet before you, and it drove out the two kings of the Amorites from before you, but not by your sword or your bow. For I gave you a land on which you had not labored, and cities which you had not built, and you have lived in them, and you are eating vineyards and olive groves which you did not plant. So in verse 1 we see it starts with then, which usually in the Bible accounts that means next or following the next main event. And what happened is Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem. So in verse 23, we see Joshua gathering them all together to a non-named place. A lot of their activities happened at Shiloh. It might have been there. It might have been in Joshua's own property that became his inheritance in the land of Ephraim. But when it says he gathered them to Shechem, it certainly sounds like it's an alternative location to where they already were. So here they are. And Shechem has a lot of history, and I got caught up in that history. In Genesis chapter 12, verses 6 and 7, I'm not going to go read all these passages, But I'm going to give you an account of some of the things that happened there. That's the first time we hear of Shechem in the Old Testament. And it's Abram's, who will become Abraham. It's his first stop in Canaan. And the scriptures are very clear. At Shechem is the Oak of Moreh. And this is the time when the Lord says, look around, walk around. To your descendants, I'm going to give this land. This is where the promise happens. The first time it's mentioned to Abraham. And Abraham built an altar to Jehovah right there at Shechem. And then we skip ahead in another event. There are some minor ones, but the events that stand out in Genesis chapter 33, verse 18 and following, Jacob is coming back to Canaan after fleeing, after his participation with his mother and deception of Esau and his father and Isaac and all of those things. He'd been to Haran, he'd been to the area of Haran, had found Laban, an uncle there, and he took Leah and Rachel as wives, and he's coming back. He's left his father-in-law. He's tired of how the agreements are working between them, and his wives support that as well. And he stops. He has a conversation with Esau. He plans that out with a lot of elaborate first meetings and interactions. And they agree that everything is reasonably okay. But he camps for the first time then at Shechem with his family. And I say with his family, Benjamin's not yet born. But he bought land there. So it's his first major point of stopping where he has possessions and he's establishing himself. And he too erected an altar named for the true God. And so he's there and he's made the altar. Their daughter Dinah, daughter of Leah, became acquainted with the people in the town at Shechem, and she visited there, and while there she was sexually abused by the prominent prince of the city. And so this prince says that he wants to take her as his wife. The sons say, well, our traditions are you gotta be circumcised for that, you and the whole community. Well, they look at this, the people of the town, and they say, this is a trade opportunity that was brought up by the sons. Jacob's here. He's wealthy. We want to interact with him. And so if we do this, it's going to be good for us. And so the men of the community agree to that. While they're in the midst of the healing from that, two of the sons, Simon and Levi, go in and kill every male in town. So Jacob's not very happy. He just bought this ground. They're just settling there. And he says, now they're all going to be against us. So he picks up and moves to Bethel. And on they go. In Deuteronomy chapter 27, Moses directed half of the tribes to be on Mount Ebal and the other half on Mount Gerizim. And if you remember that, from Ebal, they're two hills close to each other. From Ebal, they're going to recount the curses that God has promised, and from Gerizim, the blessings. It's kind of a which way do you want to go, Israel? But Shechem sets down in the valley, and it makes kind of a natural amphitheater for Shechem. I found it interesting that all happened in the general area of Shechem. And Moses had said, do this when you enter into Canaan. Joshua, in chapter 8, obeyed the command, and they did it. And this all happened around Shechem. And there's some other minor mentions, but those are some of the main events that happened up to this point in time. So let's go back to verse 1 again, talking about Joshua for a moment. Joshua says, we're going to meet at Shechem. And I think the significance of that is this is where the initial promise was voiced to Abraham. And Abraham built the altar. This was This was a part of the laying the foundation of their future. And he gathers the elders and the judges and the officers all around, and it says they're presented before God. In this case, it's Elohim, God Almighty. And so they're there in the presence of God. They recognize God's there. And so Joshua says to all the people, but obviously the ones that are going to be closest in hearing the bulk of this are going to be all those leaders who will then pass it on to the people. And the first words he says at that point are, "Thus says Yahweh," or "Thus says the Lord." Joshua is not speaking primarily on his own personal behalf here. These words precede prophetic utterance given by God to someone to pass on to someone else. So he's there looking them in the eye saying, this is from God. And as you read down through this, we'll look at a couple things that make it clear that this is prophetic speech, that Joshua here is being an ambassador of God, bringing this God's personal message to the people, to these particular hearers. And this is how he starts. He says, from ancient times, he goes clear back to the beginning of the calling of Abraham, your fathers lived beyond the river. And the river here is probably not the Jordan, but the Euphrates. Beyond the river was a euphemism for way back in the land of Haran, where they were from. And he says, Terah, the father of Abraham, the father of Nahor, served other gods. God came to an idol-worshipping family. And out of that idol-worshipping family, God says, I took your father Abraham from there. I led him through all of Canaan. I multiplied his descendants. I gave him Isaac. Was Isaac Abraham's only child? What? Tell me about any other children that might have been. Who else? Ishmael. Born through Hagar, right?
Right.
Any others?
Nope. Others through wives later.
Well, one in particular, Keturah. And Keturah had three sons. One of them was named Midian, through which we get the term Midianites. So those Midianites that were so pesky, they were Abraham's children too. And a lot of the people in that area had connections to Abraham. If you go back and think about Ishmael and his descendants, and then later on you've got Jacob and Esau, and we'll talk about that when we get there. But so here is God saying, I gave him Isaac. And Isaac was the child of the promise born of Sarah, of course, we know that. And then Isaac, he says, I gave him Jacob and Esau. And to Esau, I gave Mount Seir to possess. You remember Numbers 20, 14 and following? Edomites were mentioned. And so Moses sends to the Edomites when they're headed up to the plain up by Moab after they have scouted out the land and doing some of their wandering, and their God is taking them over to get ready to enter the promised land. And they send out to the Edomites and say, we want to pass. What do the Edomites say?
Nope,
not going to do it. Why are we talking about Edomites right now? Who are the Edomites?
Offspring of Esau.
Yeah, Esau, his nickname, other name, was Edom, because Edom means red, and he was a red-complected man. And so the Edomites are the descendants of Esau, and they were in the area of Mount Seir. And, of course, Moses sends back and says, well, listen, we're going to stay on the road. We're not going to eat. We're not going to graze your fields. We're not going to eat your food. We're not even going to drink your water. We're just going to go through. And there is also some mention of, if we do need your water, we'll pay you for it. And so Edom reconsiders and says, no. And they have to go around this area that God had given to Esau, Mount Seir, to possess. And so they have to go around to get up to the Moabite plain. And then through this utterance here in Joshua 24 that's of God, it says, during the same time as Esau's descendants were starting to settle Mount Seir, Jacob and sons went where?
Egypt.
So there had been about 400 years that they were in Egypt. That particular time frame's not mentioned, but God says then, I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt, and by my actions and there and afterwards, I brought you out. I brought your fathers, in verse 6, out of Egypt to the sea, which is, we'll find out, he calls it the Red Sea later. And Egypt pursued you there. And when the Israelites cried out because of this pursuit of the Egyptian army, complaining and in terror, I put darkness between you and them, between the Israelites and the Egyptians. And then, without getting into the wind and the dry land and the crossing and all that, God in this prophetic time says, and then I covered them with the sea and wiped them out. Your own eyes saw what I did in Egypt. You lived in the wilderness for a long time. Verse 8, I brought you to the land of the Amorites who lived east of the Jordan, and they fought with you. I gave them into your hand. You took possession of their land when I destroyed them before you. You saw it. And so you were given that land by my action. And then Balak. The king of Moab looks around and he's not happy with this. And so he wants to fight Israel. And as a part of doing that, he brings in Balaam of Beor to curse them. Verse 10, God says, I was not willing to hear him curse you. That's a real interesting statement, isn't it?
Yeah.
I wasn't going to hear that. Not going to happen. So he had to say something, so he blessed you. No, that's not quite the right way of looking at it. It's maybe a humorous way to say it, but the blessings came because God told Balaam, you say what I tell you to, and nothing else. And so he would go ask God after Balak would say, okay, you curse him. And he goes, well, I'll go on the mountain and I'll be back. And every time he came back, what did he do? He blessed Israel because that's what God told him to say. And so that interaction happened. God said, I did that because I'm not going to hear him curse you. And then you crossed the Jordan to Jericho. And they fought against you as well as many other tribes. And I gave them into your hand. In verse 12, he says, then I sent a hornet before you and drove out two kings of the Amorites, but not by your sword or bow. God did his own fighting for them. In verse 11, we get a descriptive example. There was a fleeing army in Joshua chapter 10. If we look back at it, we would see that. There was a fleeing army, and the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them. And it says, more died from the hailstones than from Israel's army. They had real strong examples that the strength of the conquest of the land of Canaan was not by their military prowess or power, but by the power of God, and he did it directly at times, and here is one of those examples. And then in verse 13, he begins to talk about what he had done as God for them that put them in the good place that they're in at this point in time. I gave you a land for which you did not labor and cities that you didn't build. You've lived in them. You're eating from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. So thinking back to the prophetic utterance that we saw in these 13 verses, when Joshua says, thus said the Lord, what word stands out in all of that prophetic utterance? Glance up through there. There's one word that is said over and over and over. I. Who is I in this? It is Yahweh speaking first person through Joshua. When Joshua starts out saying, thus says the Lord, it shifts to first person reference to God. It's very clear that these are the words God has given Joshua to say about himself. God said through Joshua's voice, through his lips, I, look what I have done, and gave them a history that started with Abraham as an part of an idol-worshipping family up beyond the river Euphrates and takes them clear up to today. None of these things were just part of the natural will of some man. Every bit of this is the full and complete specific will of God. And it's not just his will, but it's his power, his might, his dominion over mankind, history, and his creation that makes it happen. So he's recognizing and reinforcing to the Israelites, I, Yahweh, did it. And all of this is the foundation for an imperative. We had a little fun with this in a question that came up in our Bible study this last week in Ephesians. Indicatives and imperatives. They're all over the Bible. Indicatives, if you went through English class somewhere, these words might get crossed up in your mind a little bit, but basically indicatives are just mean statements proclaiming truth. Something's true. The river's up. There's no command in that. But it might be followed with, so be careful on the bridge because the river's high enough it might get you. Okay, that's the imperative. That's the command. Imperatives are commands and indicatives are the truths. And often in the scriptures, many, many times in the scriptures, great imperatives are sent our way as a foundation for the commands that God is going to give to be done. And so he gave all these great truths. It's me. I did it. I've been leading you. I've got the power. I've got the might. I've got the will. Oh, and by the way, and it's all good for you. And so all of those things are there. God says, I've shown that I can and do bless the faithful. But he finishes up with, the implication is at least, also be sure that I can and do judge the unfaithful because you watched all that too. You were there. God doesn't call it out here, but you were there as a part of judgment to the unfaithful. And as I think about that, we have a similar basis. And it gets carried forward into the New Testament in a good way. Where would you go in the New Testament to find a similar basis for why Christians ought to be faithful to God? Can you think of somewhere you'd go in the New Testament? Turn over to Hebrews chapter 11. In Hebrews chapter 11, God is, through the writer of the book, pointing out some things to the people that in many respects are absolutely amazing. And Hebrews 11 starts with these words. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for the conviction of things not seen. Now, that's a clear truth. And we should recognize quickly that when the biblical words talk about hope, it's different than what we hear so much in our common vernacular here in the U.S. and in our culture, the meaning behind it. In what we interact with today, we say hope, you really ought to take the word out and put in wish compared to what you see in the Bible, because, you know, I hope that my wife's baby will be healthy. But when we look at hope in the New Testament, we, or the rest of the Bible, we look and we see hope. The hope that we have is not some wish about the way we would desire it to come out for a particular result that we have no assurance of. In the New Testament, the word hope is full assurance of what will happen and how things will be and what promises will be kept and what God will do based on what he has told us in the scriptures. So faith is the assurance of things hoped for. It's not a desire. It's not a maybe it'll be that way. It's assurance of what is to come. And it's for the conviction of things not seen. Every time I read that, I think of the account of Thomas. I'm not going to believe that Jesus is raised from the dead until I get to interact with Jesus, until I see him, until I touch him, until I see the evidence that this is really the crucified Christ right in front of me. And you know, I'm so thankful for how Jesus handled that. He could have written Thomas off. Well, if that's the way you want to be about it. But instead, he comes and he greets Thomas and he says, "Here I am. Get what you need out of this experience. Touch me, feel me, know me, know I'm here." And of course, Thomas is very quick then to voice his belief. And Jesus said to him, "You believe because you have seen, but blessed are those that believe who have not seen." Every one of us is in that boat to some extent. And doubts are not unreasonable from time to time. Now, I'm talking minor doubts for a moment going, you know, did I really get this right? But we have no reason for doubt. We can even go back to Romans 1 and look at what condemns the unbeliever. Because God says, "I gave them the creation, they got enough." And all we have to do is go back to the creation and look around and know that there was a creator. And know that there's no other account of a creation that makes any sense beyond what we see in the scriptures. I mean, we can have full assurance of the hope within us even though we haven't seen the heavenly people. We've known and are known by Jesus the Christ. The miracle in our own lives of being born again. So when we see this chapter, God is saying to us, much like he said to the people of Israel through Joshua, "Look at what I have done." Now, the focus is the faith of the men involved. But when you get done, it's faith that was coupled with the actions of God. And this is the same thing. It's what God have done. Verse 2, "For by it men of old gained approval. By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what we see was not made out of things which are visible." Creation, Genesis 1. By faith, we know that's true. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain. God gave it clear what the sacrifice to be, and he had a righteous testimony because of God's leadership. But God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. Enoch was taken up. Now, how did Enoch get taken up? Some desire or wish of Enoch? No. But he was taken up so that he would not see death, and he was not found because God took him up, for he obtained the witness that is before us being taken up, and he was pleasing to God. Without faith, it's impossible to please him. This is a key verse. Without faith, it's impossible to please him. Him is God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. By faith, Noah, being warned about God of things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark. And we can go down through the history as seen by men of faith responding to the direction of God and the miracles of God. That ark salvation is not something that Noah dreamed up, is it? It was God completing his will in Noah's life. And so we have to back up just a little bit to get a piece of this that links it together. This Bible has very thin pages. That links it together. Go back to chapter 10, verse 19. Nope, sorry, missed it. Verse 10, 1. Okay, I lost it. I didn't look this up. I just thought I knew where it was and I was wrong. But the verse talks about having such a cloud of witness around us. And I don't see it. Is it 12:1? Oh, 12:1. Yes, I went the wrong way. Thank you, Dave. Therefore, after it goes through all these things of faith, and by the way, some of these times of faith weren't wonderful. By faith, mothers gave up their dead, gave up their son. Let me back up. Let me just get some of those because it's worth it. Also, so verse 36. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonments. They were stoned, they were sawn in two. They were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. Men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And all these things having gained approval through their faith. It needs to be said that just because we live a life of faith doesn't mean we don't endure the evil of mankind around us. And honestly, what scares me about the evil of mankind around us is my own faithfulness. It's going to take a miracle of God for me to face some of this stuff if I'm asked to face it. That's a tough thing to be faced with. Deny Jesus Christ or die. But men have been faced with that. But it's a victory when they remain faithful. And that's why it's in here. If men remain faithful through those difficult, God-hating, punishing times, certainly they win a reward. Go back to verse 6. You can't please God unless you believe he rewards the faithful. They'll be rewarded for that faithfulness. So we can't just say it's all going to come up roses if we have faith. But chapter 12, verse 1. And I'll read a little more than just verse 1. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. This is so parallel and similar to what Joshua is telling the people. We haven't got the whole message yet, but he's telling them, look at what God has done. He's laying the foundation for, don't waver. And certainly don't put yourself in a position where you and God are against each other through rebellion or through failing to honor and obey him. Questions? Thoughts? Well, let's go back to Joshua 24. And we're going to look at the rest of this chapter, beginning with verse 14. Turn the page. I don't want to do 23 again. Beginning with verse 14. Now, therefore, I'm going to read through 18 this time. Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your father served beyond the river in Egypt, and serve the Lord. If it's a disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. The people answered and said, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For the Lord our God is he who brought us and our fathers up out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, and who did these great signs in our sight and preserved us, through all the way in which we went and among the peoples through whose midst we passed. The Lord drove out from before us all the peoples, even the Amorites who lived in the land. We also will serve the Lord, for he is our God. So Joshua then now gives the strong appeal to them. Now therefore, fear the Lord, meaning serve him in sincerity. And he says that. And when he says serve him in sincerity, it's more than an attitude. The word is tamim. It means without blemish, perfect, completely, without spot. In other words, give him your service fully and completely, with full integrity, with all of your with all of who you are, and in truth, wholeheartedly, not as a show, but as faithful, joyful response to his ask, his demand for obedience and allegiance. And he also says, put away the gods of your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt. And that's an interesting statement right there. He's pointing out to them, don't start looking at your heritage to say, well, we're God people. We've been Yahweh's people forever. No, no. If you go back to Abraham before God called him out of idolatry, he was an idolater and his family with him. It's not a matter of heritage. It's a matter of who you choose to serve. And he gives them a current time command. Put away the gods your father served beyond the river. I don't think it's too far off to say he's anticipating a few of those folks still got some of those idols kind of hanging around from their Egyptian days or beyond, and they're kind of trying to play both sides of the fence a bit. I don't know that that's what he means, but he's going back to that, and he's saying, put them away. And also, he's then looking at the people who inhabit the land who are serving these same idols, and he says, put away the idols. So he's saying, get rid of these people like you were commanded. In verse 15, he says, well, if you don't see this as a good command to follow Yahweh only and put all this rest of this stuff out, then decide today, who will you serve? The God your father served, the idols beyond the river, the gods of the Amorites, the local people and their gods. But here's the alternative. Joshua says, as for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh, which is an interesting thing for a dying man to say. What does he mean, me and my house? He's not even going to be here to lead in that. What is he saying? What does that word house mean in this context? Yeah, me and my descendants, my house, the house of David was David and his offspring. The house of Joshua are the ones in his family that are going to come after him. And he's saying, my family is going to focus on serving Yahweh throughout time. Well, in verse 16, the people have their answer. Far be it from us to forsake Yahweh for some other gods. It's an obvious answer with all the information they've been given right there. It was a very compelling case. They got the logic right. This is who God is. This is what God has done. This is the way God will be doing things. So you might want to align with him. You should. Any other path is going to be destruction for you. And they say, for Yahweh is our God. He's the one who brought us and our fathers out of Egypt from slavery. He did these great things, signs in our sight. We saw it. We were there. We were preserved at every turn, even among all the various peoples we came in contact. Verse 18, Yahweh drove out all the people before us, even the Amorites who lived here. And so they say to Joshua, we will serve Yahweh. He is our God. Okay. Let's take a look at 19 through 28. Joshua said to the people in verse 19, you will not be able to serve the Lord, for he's a holy God. He's a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgression or your sins if you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods. Then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done good. The people said to Joshua, no, but we will serve the Lord. Joshua said to the people, you are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen for yourselves the Lord to serve him. And they said, we are witnesses. Now, therefore, put away the foreign gods which are in your midst and incline your hearts to the Lord, the God of Israel. The people said to Joshua, we will serve the Lord our God and we will obey his voice. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God, and he took a large stone and set it up there under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. Joshua said to all the people, behold, this stone shall be for a witness against us, For it has heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke to us. Thus it shall be for a witness against you, so that you do not deny your God. Then Joshua dismissed the people, each to his own inheritance. Joshua challenges them when they say, yes, we're going to serve God. We're going to serve Yahweh. And Joshua said, you won't be able to. After all that calling and asking, he says, this God is a holy God of might. He's a jealous God. He will not forgive your sins, your rebellions, if you turn away from him. What's he saying? He's holy, you're not. As not holy people, this is beyond your strength and your ability to do. You can't just decide to be holy. You can't just decide to be faithful. And so he's implying they're going to have to trust in God even for that. And he says, when you fail, his promised curse for failure will come upon you. Does that mean at the first failure, these people have no hope for redemption? Well, they're going to have to live through it to learn some of that hope of redemption. Go over to 2 Chronicles chapter 7. 2 Chronicles 7. And we're going to look at verses 11 through 22. This is at the dedication of the temple under Solomon. Now, I'm not saying this is the only time that God talks about redemption of the people of Israel, but this is a time that has a lot of meaty words to it. And so in verse 11, we're going to read down through 22. It's a little bit long, but we'll get there. Thus Solomon finished the house of the Lord and the king's palace and successfully completed all that he had planned on doing in the house of the Lord in his palace. Then the Lord appeared to Solomon at night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. If I shut up the heavens so there is no rain, or if I command the locusts to devour the land, or if I send pestilence among my people, and my people who are called by my name and humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, will forgive their sin, and will heal their land. Now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayers offered in this place. For now I have chosen and consecrated this house that my name may be there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. As for you, if you walk before me as your father David walked, and all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish your royal throne as I covenanted with your father David, saying, you shall not lack a man to be a ruler in Israel. But if you turn away and forsake my statutes and my commands, which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will uproot you from my land, which I have given you, and this house, which I have consecrated for my name, and I will cast out of my sight, and I will make a proverb and a byword amongst all the peoples. As for this house which was exalted, everyone who passes by will be astonished and say, why has the Lord done this to this land and this house? And they will say, because they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers who brought them from the land of Egypt, and they adopted other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore he has brought all this adversity on them. And so what we see here is the promise of God about restoration after judgment, if the people will humble themselves and call on his name, he will bring them back. But once again, he gives the hard message. If they forsake me, I will judge them. And so that's what you see throughout the Old Testament. You see their rebellion, you see their restoration. You see their rebellion, you see them carted off. You see them brought back to rebuild the temple. And so God continues with his people, but Joshua's got his right. You will have great difficulty in being holy as God is holy. But the people persist in their affirmation of their faithfulness. Verse 21 in Joshua, 24, they say, no, we're going to be faithful. And Joshua says, then, okay, you know how holy God is. You know what your fathers did. You know where we've been and where we're going and what the expectation is. So you are providing a testimony that you will serve Yahweh. In other words, you are going to be held accountable for your words. And they say, yes, we so testify. It's like in court. We have made the proclamation. And in verse 23, he says, all right then, put away the foreign gods which are among you. We wind up back at that point again. Put your attention on God's words. And why does he need to say it? Because obviously it's still a problem for them and will be in their future. The people repeat, we will serve Yahweh our God, we will obey his voice. And so in verse 25, Joshua creates a covenant, an agreement with the people right then. It's really not so much between he and the people, but between God and the people. And he also writes it into his laws and ordinance there in Shechem. It's a binding agreement. It's enacted. It's a legal order. And then Joshua recorded these words in the book of the law of God. Undoubtedly, the book of the law of God was what Moses had written. It was what the priests were carrying along with the ark. And he added to that book of laws recorded by Moses. And so it was there. And then he also took a large stone and he placed it under an oak. Have we heard about an oak in Shechem before? There was an oak when Abraham showed up and built his altar. It says there was an oak there. And he puts up a large stone under the oak. And he said, this is a sanctuary of the Lord. It's a holy place. Now, the tabernacle's at Shiloh, but this is holy. It's the Oak of Moreh, where Abraham's altar was, where when Jacob returned, it's where he built an altar. And right there in front of them, they're putting up this stone as a testimony so that if they say, no, we kept our commitments. This stone, it said, heard everything God said, heard what you said, and it's there to remind them of their agreement before God. Questions, comments? There's certainly a lot of parallel for us to consider from time to time about. It's different. We have Christ, they didn't. So there's differences, but the basic truths are still the same. Serve the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Jesus said it was the greatest command, and it still is yet today, along with love your neighbor like you love yourself. Out of that flow all the rest of the commands, Jesus said. And that too works for us even in this day. Well, next time we'll do Joshua's death and burial, and then we're going to do some looking back at where we've been since we started in Genesis 1:1. Thank you much.